Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. Welcome today. I really appreciate you tuning in. Today, I have with me David Blatt, who's the author of a new book. It's called The Vegan Imperative, Why We Must Give Up Meat and Why We Don't. David is a former animal law attorney. He had been the executive director of Vegan Action. He's the co-founder of Dharma Voices for Animals and director of the film Animals and the Buddha. He has been advocating for veganism for over 30 years. David, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Karen. It's great to be here.
We've been doing this thing a long time, you and I. I'm surprised we haven't crossed paths before.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that we became vegan the very same year, 1988.
And how did it happen for you in 1988?
Well, I had become a vegan in 1977 when I was a freshman in college. And I didn't know anything about farmed animals at the time. I didn't even know anything about the animal rights movement. I didn't know that there was an animal rights movement. And then in 1988, I went to an exhibit by PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, at Penn Law, where I was attending. And I learned about farmed animals. And I saw that if I'm going to be a vegetarian and I don't want to harm animals, I need to go vegan. So I did.
And just like that.
Kind of. it's hard when, you know, there's two steps. There's deciding it's the right thing to do, and there's actually doing it. And yeah. Likewise, when I was a vegetarian, I became aware of animal suffering pretty acutely when I was 12 after a tragedy. But I didn't make the connection to food until my freshman year in college, where someone kind of incidentally said, well, there's really no difference between fur, which I was opposed to, and eating meat. One's for vanity, one's for taste, but they're both unnecessary. When he said that, something clicked. Mm-hmm. And I said, this makes sense. I might have to go vegetarian. And again, I wasn't quite ready. I think it took maybe 2 weeks before I said, okay, I'm going vegetarian. Same thing 11 years later, I learned about farmed animals. And I decided, yeah, this makes sense. I'm probably going to have to go vegan. It was a little tough at the time. The woman I was dating, we were in a long distance relationship. I had just moved from Atlanta to Pennsylvania. I was in law school. She was in med school. There was a lot of stress. I knew she wouldn't be happy. That was a factor. But I just, at that point, it wasn't imperative. And I decided to go vegan.
Well, you hit on a lot of points in your own life that are very true in most other people's lives when the light goes on and they realize who they are eating. And the next question is what to do about it. So when I first reached out to you, I had interviewed Gary Francione. I've known him a long time. We've spoken many times. He's been on the program a number of times. And after I spoke with him, I was talking to my partner, whose name is also Gary, Gary DiMattei, co-host of this program. And he kept talking about the vegan imperative. And then I Googled it and I thought, what else is out there with the title vegan imperative? I found a vegan store, an online store that sells bags and clothes and all kinds of personal care products. That was fun. And there was a book in 2011 called The Vegetarian Imperative. And then I thought of Gary Steiner, who I had interviewed on this program, who teaches philosophy at my alma mater, Bucknell University. And I got to meet him and his partner, Gary Steiner and his partner. We all got together and had a lovely meal together in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. There's a blog post online called Animal Rights and the Vegan Imperative. It's the only blog post on this WordPress site. I'm not quite sure, but it's worthy of just one, especially this one, right? And then there was your book. And one thing led to another. When I discovered you were co-founder of Dharma Voices for Animals, I knew that my friend Patty Brightman was involved with that as well. So I reached out to her and she led me to you. And here we are. So when you wrote me you noticed that I had talked to Gary Francione, and you said your approach is different than Gary's. And I read your book, but I want you to maybe briefly explain in your own words what your approach is to veganism.
Okay, let me just say a word about Gary. Gary happened to be teaching law when I went to Penn Law, just by coincidence. So we naturally connected. I actually did an independent study with him on animal law while in law school. So he planted the seeds for my future career as an animal law attorney. I wrote the book. There's a few reasons I wrote the book. And there's two main incidents which led to me writing it right now. Let me talk a little about those. I've literally been thinking about these issues for over 40 years. And several years ago, I was talking to a very good friend of mine, Mike, and I start the book with this conversation. Now, I know Mike to be very kind and very caring. And one day, quite out of the blue, he said to me, "Dave, I've been listening to your talking about veganism for many years now, and I have to tell you something. I agree." There's a pause. "But I'm still going to eat meat." So this just raised a question I've literally been stumped by for over 30 years. Why do good, caring people continue to eat meat despite the harm it causes? And I should say something. I'm using the word meat, and I use it in the book. Normally when I talk, I never use the word meat. There's a lot of power in language. I always use the word animals. I chose to use the word meat because people are more receptive to it, I find. But what I'm going to try to do in this interview is use the word animals.
Okay.
So that was one incident. The second incident, and again, we go back, and I'm sure you're aware of this, back when we became vegan in 1988, no one had ever heard the word vegan. No. In fact, I had never heard the word vegan. And then when I became executive director of Vegan Action in 2000, still very few people had heard the word vegan. Well, something's happened in the last 5 to 10 years, and veganism has exploded. Now everyone knows what it means. When you go to a restaurant and ask if you have vegan dishes, they don't say, "What's that mean?" They know what it means. And it all came to a head for me about a year and a half ago when the Screen Actors Guild, in their annual award ceremony, decided to go plant-based or vegan. When I read that, I knew veganism had arrived. And it was time to put my thoughts down on paper.
Oh, okay.
So to answer your question, that's the long answer. The short answer is I wrote it specifically or mainly for people who are caring and kind and nevertheless still eat animals. So what I did in the book, I divided it into two parts. In the first part, I talk about why vegan. And I lay out the three main reasons people go vegan. There's the moral imperative, the environmental imperative, the health imperative. And I also talk about speciesism. And hopefully we'll be able to get to that.
Absolutely.
I think it's important for this particular audience. I also add a chapter on animal law. Not so much because it's directly related to veganism, but I just thought it would be interesting. In the second part of the book, I address the question, why not vegan? Why do people, despite the harm it causes, continue to eat animals? Why do good, caring people? And I emphasize that because people, you know, all my friends and pretty much everyone in my family is compassionate. They care, yet most of them continue to eat animals. So the question is why, and that's what I address in the second part of the book.
So your approach was to find out why, and you found out the answer from different people's perspectives. The reason isn't the same for everyone. Did you learn something from that in terms of where we go from here? How do we become better activists? Because that's the mystery to me, how to make people vegan. That's one of my goals, to make vegans. And it's a challenge with some people. Some people are easy, an easy sell, and some people are very, very challenging. Some people have surprised me that after listening to me preach like a broken record. 20, 30 years later, they come around and say, yeah, I'm vegan now.
Yes, that raises a few points. One of them, and it's important, is that for most people, including you and me, it's a process. You know, when we learned about vegetarianism, it took a while before we actually became vegetarian. Same with veganism. So in a sense, all we can do is plant seeds, give people information, and let them digest it at their own speed. Some people will become vegan immediately, some will think about it, and then maybe down the road, something else will arise, and they'll think about it some more. And eventually, they'll become vegan. Even if they don't, they might eat more vegan. They might eat an extra meal a week vegan. When they go to a restaurant, if there's different options, they might choose the vegan one. So there's a benefit in that regard.
Well, like you and me, people who understand what's really happening and have acted on it, it's especially frustrating to know the billions of animals that are suffering every year. We're so helpless. It's next to impossible to make significant change. It takes time. And it's something we have to sit with somehow, knowing that this is a process that takes time, even though we want it to happen yesterday. And it's difficult to live with that, knowing that, especially now. You use the word imperative because we're in this climate crisis. Okay, not only are we torturing all these animals, but our own species is at risk now of ending because we're destroying our home planet Earth. It's very difficult to sit with.
It is hard. And I compare it to other social justice movements. And I use the word social justice movement intentionally, because I do believe veganism is a social justice movement. We don't normally think of animals in that context, but when you think about it, animals are an integral part of our society. They're part of our social fabric. So social justice does apply to them. And if we look back historically on any social justice issue, civil rights, which started with slavery, took a long time to end slavery, hundreds of years. Even after slavery, the struggle for civil rights continues up until this day. The same with women's rights. Really, it was only 100 years ago when women were able to vote. I mean, that's nothing. Before then, they actually didn't have that right.
And we still haven't passed the Equal Rights Amendment.
Exactly. And women still don't have equal pay. So these things take time. I'm encouraged. I think social media is really helping. And I think it's social media that explains the boom in veganism. People can share these ideas. So I'm optimistic about the future. I think it will happen. It may actually end up being driven more by economics than anything else. But you know, I think all these factors come into play, the moral factor, the environmental factor, and the health factor.
You use your interviews with other people to try and explain what our reasons are not to be vegan. And I'm going to use it now. I really like the approach of saying, why aren't you vegan, rather than why am I vegan? I like that.
Turn it around.
Absolutely. Why aren't you vegan? I was talking to my cousin last night. He was basically explaining to me he couldn't be like me. He'd like to lose weight. I've coached with him in the past about changing his diet. And he basically just says, I like meat. And when I'm under stress, it's a comfort food for me. It's so layered, because what we go to as a comfort food, for example, can actually be reinforcing some of the problems that we're experiencing. It's a catch-22 almost. And to break away from that cycle seems a tremendous challenge for humans.
It is a challenge. In fact, one of the interviews, I should say in the book is based on my personal narrative, but I also interviewed, I think, 10 to 12 vegetarians, vegans, and non-vegans, and tell their story and intersperse some of their comments. And there's also, I also rely on a bunch of scientific studies, psychological studies. And one of the interviewees talks about this specifically. She's now a vegetarian. She talks about in college, when it was really hard for her, she would go and eat a steak because it was comfort food. It reminded her of home.
Yeah.
And that's something hard to overcome. So, you know, psychologically, as you mentioned, there's no single bullet to explain why people continue to eat animals. And for everyone, it is different. So what's important for one person might not be important for another. So in the book, I pretty much go over everything I could think of. It's really comprehensive. You know, I don't go as deep into some things as I might, but I go into all the possible reasons. So hopefully when people read it, there'll be parts of it where they connect with it. They say, oh yeah, that's explains me. And really the whole second half of the book goes into those various reasons. And the comfort food is one of them.
I don't remember which person it was that you were interviewing, but you wrote that they said, it hasn't crossed my mind. And as you just mentioned, everybody knows about veganism now. So that's really a serious case of denial, because everybody knows about veganism now in 2021, at least here in the United States. And to say it hasn't crossed my mind is really lying to yourself.
Well, I think it's something different. I think people, when they hear about it, think of it as something abstract. That's something other people do. Maybe these weird people, maybe not, but something others do, not for themselves. So I don't think they really sit down and say, this really is something I should consider for myself. And that's the hard part of, one of the sections in the book is on avoidance. And one of the stories I tell two stories. One is one of the interviewees is an environmentalist, and she's also 99.7% vegan. And she talks about going to environmental meetings and people are eating meat and eating animals. And it's very frustrating for her. And I've had a similar experience. I mentioned in the book, I've been meditating for over 20 years now. It's a very important part of my life. I've done a lot of studying. I've lived on monasteries. And I try to introduce, and most, when you go on retreat, it's generally vegetarian. But I was shocked after I started meditating to find out most practitioners are not vegetarian. And that's a long story I could talk about for hours. But I try to have my community, it's called a Sangha, formally adopt vegetarianism at their functions. And I was surprised that not only did they not want to do it, they didn't want to talk about it. Now, meditators are taught to face reality head on. That's the essence of meditation. Yet they chose not to face it head on. So if meditators are not facing it head on, it's no surprise that people in general are not facing it head on.
Well, I think that's a book you need to write. Just focus on meditators and why they eat meat. Although different people have written similar subjects, like why it's okay in Buddhism or in other religions, where most of them, when they started, really were promoting veganism. And then at some point, they let the meat creep in somehow or found reasons to allow it. Yes. Reasons or excuses.
Yes, justifications. Yes, as I said, I could talk about the Buddhist perspective for hours, but briefly I'll say there's actually a split. There's two different lineages. There's a split in the lineages. One of them, called Mahayana, which is Tibetan and Zen, they're vegetarian. If you look at the scriptures, the Buddha says, no, you're prohibited from eating meat. In the other lineage, which is mine, happens to be mine, Theravada, there's actually disagreement as to whether the Buddha was actually a vegetarian. So a friend of mine, I'm friends with a Mahayanan monk, and he keeps telling me, you should become Mahayana, because they embrace vegetarianism. But I'm sticking with my practice.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about some vocabulary. Can we talk about, three words: speciesism, anthropocentrism, and anthropomorphism.
Okay.
My favorite isms.
All right. There's actually an entire chapter on speciesism. That's how important I think it is. So when you're talking about isms in general, what you're doing, and I use racism and sexism, and also to some degree, homophobism. When you're talking about isms in general, they're all forms of oppression. And what you're doing is you're taking a group and there's some arbitrary characteristic and you're calling them other. So with race, their characteristic is obviously arbitrary. With gender, you're saying, well, men are different than women, and that's arbitrary. And with animals, you're saying, well, humans are different than animals, and that's arbitrary. Now, this doesn't deny differences. There are obviously differences between men and women, between animals and humans. But when you're talking about oppression, the differences are arbitrary because the objects of your impression suffer. They're harmed by your impression, right? So with racism, obviously, the harm is obvious. There was slavery and it continues to today. With women, the harm was obvious. They couldn't vote and they still don't have equal rights. With animals, the harm is obvious. We're killing 70 billion animals a year. And animals, just like us, they suffer. Animals, just like us, don't want to be harmed. They want to live. If you see animals in the wild, you'll see they don't want to die. They'll do anything they can not to die, just like us. So what I do then, I compare speciesism with racism and sexism as a form of oppression. And I'd like to read a section of my book, which is directly on point, which I probably couldn't say any better live.
Okay.
And it talks about, and this is particularly important for a progressive crowd who kind of understands, you know, the implications of racism and sexism and other forms of oppression. So I write, if you reject the notion of oppression in general, you oppose it in all its manifestations. It makes no sense to be against racism, but support sexism. It's incongruous to grant rights to women, but deny them to the LGBTQ community. If you are opposed to racism, sexism, homophobia, or any other form of discrimination, it is inconsistent to be a speciesist. It is inconsistent to eat meat. And then I actually get a little stronger. My approach generally is inclusive and non-threatening. But in this chapter, I thought I should be a little forceful. So I wrote, when we eat meat, we are engaging in an oppressive act. This is a difficult truth to accept. People never self-identify as oppressors. They are, in their minds, simply advancing their own interests. But in speciesism, just as in other forms of oppression, it is done at the expense of others. Speciesism, like racism and sexism, is a rationalization, not a justification. So really what I'm asking the listeners here is to consider whether they themselves, when they eat meat, are engaging in a form of oppression. I believe they are, and if they agree, hopefully they'll decide they don't want to continue that.
Well, we just have to keep putting it in front of them in a loving, non-judgmental, compassionate way, right?
Exactly.
And philosophers and scientists throughout history have not been very helpful. I think finally today we're having a more truthful conversation with some philosophers and scientists. But people like Descartes and others, it's just so hard to believe that they didn't think animals, that were persons, like Gary Francione likes to say, that animals think, animals feel. We have no idea what's going on in their head. And to assume that there's nothing there when they're screaming or looking sweet or responding to us when we're going through something emotional and they seem to know, to say that there's nothing going on, how did they justify that? How did they take their informed position, their with their credentials, and say, I know this to be true?
Yes, Descartes is the perfect example. and I write about him. He denied animal sentience. He thought they were automatons who did not feel pain. They were simply reacting without pain. And unfortunately, during his life, it was the beginning of vivisection, experiments on animals. Mm. And Descartes himself engaged in vivisection. I actually quote, I quote from Descartes, where he experimented on a dog, and he did it on the basis that it's not really feeling pain despite its howls. There's not much you can say. I do, in response, I cite my all-time favorite Western philosopher, David Hume, and he's in shock about Descartes. He's responding directly to Descartes and says, how could you even think this?
Well, that's where anthropocentrism comes in to some extent, thinking that human beings are the most important thing on this planet or in the universe even, that we're right about everything.
Yes. In fact, one of the interviewees, I specifically asked about this, and she said, I don't remember the exact quote, something to the effect of, well, I'm a human and I just think humans are different. And I'm sorry about that, but that's just how I feel. And I think it has, you know, it goes way back. If you look at the Judeo-Christian tradition, at the beginning, man is made in God's image. So note that it's man, it's not woman, and it's man. And of course, the people who had the power back then were the men. And it just, it continues. We have Galileo, who said that the earth actually revolves around the sun. And what happened to him? You know, the church was all over him and said, no, you can't say this, because it went against this view of man as the center of the universe. So I think, you know, there's been progress, particularly with Darwin showing the connection between animals and humans. So I think people are beginning to understand that perhaps man isn't the center of the universe. And when I say man, I mean humankind. But still, that's a tough bias to overcome. It's probably tougher than any of the other biases, whether it's racism or sexism, to see your other species, not necessarily equal to humans, I don't talk in those terms, but to see them as lesser and therefore we can do whatever we want with them. I think that's the bias that we're trying to overcome.
And then we can add the other is an anthropomorphism, where in some ways we're blamed for thinking that animals can have traits like we have. And maybe they don't have the exact same traits, but maybe they do have some that they feel and that they can have emotions. And some people blame us for saying, oh, you know, you can't do that. But yeah, how could you not do that?
I think one of the studies that I pointed to said that vegetarians are more likely to be anthropomorphic, to actually assign human qualities to animals than non-vegetarians. I actually think it's a kind of cause and effect where people who eat animals don't want animals to be like humans. So that meat eating or animal eating causes them to conclude that animals aren't like humans. So there's a kind of funny interaction going on there.
I think the ones that surprise me the most, the people that surprise me the most, are the ones who live with animals like dogs and cats and love them like they're their family and treat them like their family and seem to connect with them on a very powerful emotional level. And yet they don't make that connection of some people eat dogs in other societies, and in this society you're choosing to eat another animal that may even have more intelligence than your dog. Of course, I don't even want to talk about intelligence because we have no way to really gauge what intelligence is, especially in other species who are capable of doing so many things that we can't do. I mean, can you change your spots?
Yes, I had a dog who I'm pretty sure was smarter than me. She was certainly wiser than me. But that is one thing. that is a big stumper. I actually write about this in the book. I posit that one reason people continue to eat animals is because they don't understand how rich the emotional lives of animals are. So I posit that as a theory, but then I said, well, in the United States, over half the households, or approximately half the households, have a dog. And if you have a dog, clearly you know that animals have a rich emotional life. So, and they continue to eat animals. So that is actually a stumper.
The stumper, indeed. Oh, goodness. But I want to believe that if we have the time, we will get to a better place.
I think it will happen. I share your optimism.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about you. You talk about some of your history in the book, and I wanted to touch on some of them. So you were responsible for the Certified Vegan logo, or you participated in making that happen with Vegan Action, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, we instituted that when I was executive director of Vegan Action. It was really a team collaboration. I remember it well. We weren't sure, coming up with a logo is a tough thing to do. Everyone would pitch in. And then finally, we settled on the logo. And at the time, again, there were very few companies out there that were vegan. And there was virtually no vegan market. So once I left Vegan Action, I passed it on to Chrissy Vandenberg, who was a volunteer. And she's been executive director ever since. And now the Certified Vegan logo, for people who aren't familiar with it, it's the logo that is a heart with a V in the middle. And I actually have a watermark of that on the cover of the book. Mm. And now the logo is used on over 10,000 products.
Wow.
So this is important for vegans. A lot of people, if you're not vegan, you might not appreciate this, but when you become vegan, when you go into a supermarket, you probably spend half your time reading labels. You're just looking at everything. Even now I read labels.
Sure.
I like to shop at Grocery Outlet because they have all sorts of funky things. But every time I do, I have to read the labels. So when you see the vegan certified logo, you don't have to read the labels. You know it's vegan and you just pick it up and buy it.
Do you know how it's done, how the certification is done?
I don't know how they're doing it now. I just remember how we did it back at the time. But one aspect of it is looking at the ingredients. And there are a lot of ingredients that can actually be vegan or non-vegan. The most common one is gelatin. So when you see gelatin, it could come from bone marrow or it can be plant-based. And it's important to know. So Vegan Action will actually look at all those ingredients and make sure that they are, in fact, vegan. They use a very high standard. For example, and we discussed this thoroughly when we instituted the logo. For example, most people don't know about this, and it's out there. It's not that important. But companies like, I think it's CNS or CNH Sugar, they actually use bones in the process. So there are some vegans out there who don't want to use that sugar because bones are used in the process. So Vegan Action uses the lowest common denominator to make sure that all of the ingredients are strict vegan.
Well, that's good to know. I like seeing the logo, but it's probably a habit too that I probably still read the ingredients.
Yes. I understand.
Well, I can't help myself.
You don't trust it.
Well, no, it's just.
No, I'm the same way. I saw, what was it? The Beyond Meat is now selling patties at Grocery Outlet.
Yeah.
And I know it's vegan, but I went ahead and I read the ingredients.
Well, I also look for organic. So I'm also checking what's organic and what isn't on my labels. And it's just something I do.
Yes.
But fortunately for me, I don't know about most people, but for me, I'm trying to eat more whole food vegan. So there aren't labels.
Yes.
Makes it easier. Okay. I wanted to talk about you said you were in Myanmar for 2.5 years, and right now they're going through some really difficult times. I'm not sure how if you want to talk about any of your experience there and how you feel about what's going on now.
Yeah, no, I was actually there in Myanmar itself for 2.5 months. And that was when I first went. The problem was that I was living on a monastery, Pau Auk Forest Monastery, and I was sick the entire time. It's just one thing after another. So I had actually bought a one-way ticket. You know, once I decided to delve into meditation full-time at that time, I bought a one-way ticket. I left everything and went to Myanmar to this particular monastery. And I should say, one reason I chose the monastery is because it's one of the few vegetarian monasteries. So when I went to the monastery, I was sick the entire time. And I pretty much never left the monastery. So I wasn't really thrown into the culture of Myanmar outside of the monastery. I was exposed to the culture to some degree. It's not really about veganism, but it's kind of interesting. When you live on a monastery, monks don't have any money. They rely on lay people for food. So at mealtime, there were a lot of monks at this monastery, I think over 100, maybe a couple hundred. And lay people would come and extended families would come. 30, 40 people would come and they'd prepare the meal. And the monks would stand on line and walk through the line and the people would put the food in their alms bowls. And it was good merit or good karma for these people. Huh. That was my main experience. It is heartbreaking though, particularly since Myanmar is a Buddhist country and Buddhism is explicitly nonviolent. There's five precepts. They're kind of like the Ten Commandments. And the first precept is do not kill. And it's understood and to include animals, which is one reason, you know, I'm drawn to it. So, and it's pretty much the most important. Buddhism is founded on compassion and on loving kindness. So in a Buddhist country, to see they're really killing, you know, minority groups.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking and it's really hard to understand also. It is a tragedy.
Yep. Humans are humans and we do many strange things. One of the last things I wanted to talk about on this show, it's all about food. I want to talk about food and the food that you like. And I want to start with the fact that you mentioned that you like to eat tortilla chips, but they're not healthy. And I wanted to tell you that I make my own tortillas at home with organic masa harina. It's just organic masa harina and water. And then I make my own tortilla chips from that by baking them, and they're perfectly healthy. So I just wanted to offer that to you if you really wanted to have them and not really have the unhealthy variety, you could have these.
Yes, you have my email address. Please send that to me.
I will. They're fun to make. I just posted yesterday, I made 3 dozen tortillas. I made a nice big stack of tortillas.
Well, that's great. In fact, I've looked into making my own. What happened during the pandemic, I just like probably like a lot of people, I started cooking more. Yep. And at this point, I'm making my own tofu.
Oh, great.
And the reason for that, it's a laborious process. But the reason for that is, apart from not eating animals, the environment is particularly important. And everyone knows about global warming. But also, I think maybe even equally important is plastic and the use of plastic. You know, it's getting everywhere. It doesn't biodegrade. It's killing animals. It's just horrific. So what I've tried to do is reduce as much as possible my plastic. And unfortunately, before the pandemic, I was able to get bulk tofu at my local co-op. But once the pandemic started, because of, you know, the fear of spread, they no longer have that. So they sell the, you know, 1 pound blocks in plastic.
Yeah.
And I just can't bring myself to do it. I started making tofu. I make my own tahini. I make my own, you might not be familiar with this. I make my own seitan.
Yeah, we know.
Oh, okay, you do that.
Yeah, we were just talking to Sky Michael Conray, who has a new book out called Crafting Satan. He's amazing. If you haven't seen his work, he's got a Facebook page, The Gentle Chef. What he does with Satan is out of this world.
Oh, that's great to know. Because I've been making it for about 6 months. It's pretty good, but I can tell it could be a lot better. That'd be great.
Oh, he has all the secrets. All of them.
Wow. And he shares them.
I don't want to say that he's obsessed. I just want to say he's passionate. And he's been working on it for years. And he put it all in the book.
Wow. Yep. All right.
That's a great tip.
I'm picking up some great tips here.
Or maybe you just listen to my interview with him because we talk about some of the tips. I think that'll help. He talks about how to not make it spongy. And then he'll mix tofu in different amounts with the seitan to make what he calls chicken, beef, and pork. He spells them differently. It was fun.
Yeah, I've been wondering about that. You know, I went online to look up soy chicken, how to make soy chicken.
Yeah.
And when I did, interestingly, apparently there's a dish called soy chicken, which actually is chicken.
Oh.
And so all the recipes were for actual chicken. I couldn't find how to make soy chicken.
That's funny. Well, he's got it all figured out. He, if I remember correctly, he puts it in a food processor. And by putting it in the food processor for a long enough time, it changes the texture and makes it more stringy, pulley like chicken.
That's great, because being rubbery is one of the problems I've run into.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So.
Well, good. Good for you. I think more people should learn how to make things.
It's fun.
The pandemic has not been good for the environment because everything has to come packaged, and a lot more of us have been getting things delivered, and that's more bags and more packaging and not good.
Right. You know, that reminds me of one stat. I think it's worth mentioning.
Okay.
And I was surprised to learn this. It's in the environmental section. That when we're talking about global warming, animal agriculture, meaning, you know, the meat and dairy industries, they contribute more to global warming than the transportation sector. In other words, you cause more damage eating meat or eating animals than driving your car. And I was surprised to learn that.
Yeah, and it's really hard to arrive at exact numbers for those sorts of things. And I think if we really did a very vigorous study, if we were able to get all the numbers, I think we'd find that animal agriculture was far worse than anybody has ever estimated for the environment.
Yes,
my opinion.
I will be. I agree.
Yes. Well, David, thank you. This has been a pleasure chatting with you, my fellow vegan since 1988.
Yes, Karen. Thank you.
It was a good year.
We met.
Yes, I'm glad we finally got to meet virtually. Thank you for writing The Vegan Imperative, Why We Must Give Up Meat and Why We Don't. It's important to understand this phenomenon in order to move forward and try and make more positive change. We'll get there.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, the goal is not to get people to become vegan overnight. The goal is to have people, and again, I emphasize this, good, caring people listening to this program, to actually think about it seriously for themselves.
Very good. Thank you, David Blatt. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Be well.
Okay. Thank you, Karen.
David Blatt, everybody, the author of The Vegan Imperative, Why We Must Give Up Meat and Why We Don't. And to continue this conversation, I invite Gary DiMattei, co-host of It's All About Food, to talk a little bit more about why we don't.
Hi, Karen. It's great to see you. Great interview with David. He's quite an extraordinary guy, isn't he?
He is. We talked a little bit on the program just a few minutes ago about how he was responsible for the vegan certified logo label,
right,
with Vegan Action.
Oh, I look at those all the time on products.
We didn't talk about he was a lawyer and he was worked on a number of lawsuits, but he was responsible for the ban on foie gras in California.
Extraordinary. Yeah, an animal law attorney. Wow. And also, you mentioned he went vegan the same time you did.
Yeah, 1988. It was a good year for me and for David.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Why don't people go vegan, more people?
Well, That's my new question. I'm not going to say why I'm vegan anymore. I'm going to turn the tables and say, why aren't you vegan?
Yeah, you've always done that, and really in a wonderful way, too. You have said to people who are meat eaters who say that you are being extreme by being vegan, you have always flipped it on them and said, well,
I think meat eating is extreme.
Yes.
Yes, I said that on Geraldo at Large some time
and
ago.
You've said it before then, and you've said it
because
after then.
Because it is true. Extreme.
It's very extreme.
And somehow our psyche, the human cultural psyche, has learned to accept murder.
Yes.
As normal
and
for
it's
our
not.
Food. And do you think, she asked sarcastically, if this extends to the way we treat fellow humans?
I think it has a lot to do with it, but I am no expert.
No,
on...
but who cares? We just like to chat about it.
But you know what scares me is that the experts probably are meat eaters.
Oh, well, of course.
So people who are trying to figure out why there is all of this violence in the world are contributing to the violence by eating meat. Isn't that an interesting paradox?
Well, David talked about how he's been meditating for a long time. And when he was doing these retreats with people who are serious meditators, he was always shocked because they were meat eaters and they didn't want to face that truth.
Right.
And that's what meditation's supposed to be about, where you're facing your realities and learning how to accept them. Well,
we talk a lot about addictions in this society of ours, and we never talk about the meat addiction.
Yeah. Can we call it an addiction? What can we call it?
I mean, I talk to people all the time, and they say they just can't give up meat. And to me, it sounds like somebody saying, I just can't. I've tried, but I just can't stop smoking. Or I've tried, and I just can't give up crack. They do it with the same intensity as someone who says, you know, I've tried to kick alcohol, but I just can't do it. I just like it so much.
Okay, let's not get judgmental here, but you know what I don't like? I don't like the phrase, I'm doing the best I can.
Right.
Because most of the time when I hear it, and I'll confess, I've said it, I'm doing the best I can. But we could always do better.
Yeah, it's usually, you usually say that when you're trying to, blow somebody off when they're like on your back about something.
Yes.
You usually say, yeah, well, I'm doing the best I can. I don't think they have a good enough reason for not doing it other than what everyone says. And that is, I'm not giving up meat because I love it so much.
Yeah.
And
period.
Period.
But it's...
And they're, you know, the people that I've talked to, and again, like you, I don't judge. Although I should, but I don't. And I don't preach, although I should, but I don't.
I preach.
Yeah, but you preach in a way that is backed by science. And a lot of people just don't want to hear the science behind it.
You know, it is backed by science. But the scary thing is that philosophers and scientists for a long time have promoted the exploitation of animals.
Yes.
In a weird way. And you wonder, I just don't get it. I keep saying it because I just don't believe it. How could you say an animal doesn't feel pain? How can you say that an animal doesn't feel...
When all of the proof is there that they do.
If there was a higher civilization or a species that was higher or more intelligent than humans, could you imagine what a good time they would have talking about humans?
Oh, yeah.
Those crazy humans. So the good news is we have the internet, we have social media, more people are finding out the benefits of a whole food vegan diet. I'm not just saying vegan and I'm not saying plant-based. I'm saying vegan and healthy and how it's important not to kill animals and not to raise animals for food because it's a disaster for the environment. It's not good for our health. And if you really think about it, it's not very nice. Some people are getting it, and I'm hoping now that we reach a certain momentum where more and more people get it, because there's safety in numbers.
Yes.
So the more people do it, well, it's the rhinoceros syndrome, too.
Well, it also,
UNESCO wrote about.
Yes, rhinoceros. And some folks even eat rhinoceros,
oh.
But we won't go there. But you know, it also, for some reason, little by little is becoming cooler. You know, it's all about being cool.
Yeah.
A lot of cool cats out there are...
It was not cool 30 years ago.
Right, but a lot of cool cats are vegan, you know.
That helps.
We've talked about a lot of them, and we've talked about Robert Downey Jr. before.
Yep.
And we've also talked about mushroom bacon a couple of weeks ago. And guess what? He's invested a ton of money in this mushroom bacon thing that you and I were talking about a couple of weeks ago.
Well, maybe he heard us talking about it. Said,
yeah.
I got to get behind this.
He might have even listened to our program. Is that what you're saying? Well, then we need to get Robert Downey Jr. on the show and find out what his excuse is for not going vegan.
Yeah, well, maybe he's thinking about it.
I think he is. But this mushroom bacon thing is really getting a lot of attention, and it's starting to sound like it might even be cool.
You know, it's funny. So many people love bacon, and they don't seem to care that it comes from a sentient, intelligent animal, the pig. What do they love about it? Salty, sweet, fat.
Right.
Oil, sugar, salt, that famous combo.
Right.
And it's not hard to make an oil, sugar, fat combo that's plant-based.
They've been doing it with tempeh for years. They've been making tempeh bacon.
Right, but it's not exactly like bacon. And so now somebody's going into the lab and making it...
Making it taste...
Exactly the
behave
same.
Behave more like bacon. Well, that's just ridiculous. Although... I'm talking like someone who has never eaten meat before, and unfortunately, I have eaten meat before. And I think that's the thing a lot of people can't give up. And so hopefully bacon, this mushroom bacon thing, will be something that folks can transition off of the animal and onto mushrooms. I'll try it, and I don't like mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
There's another special day coming up. And no, I won't talk about your birthday on April 22nd. And no, I won't ask everybody to write in to responsibleeatingandliving.org and tell you how wonderful you are and wish you a happy birthday. I would never do that, especially on the air. I would never say how you're a powerhouse in the vegan movement, because you would just be all modest and say, no, not me. There are other people working harder than you. And I would never disagree with you on the air, especially a few days or 2 days before your birthday. But there's a special day coming up, and it's April 22nd, and it's Earth Day.
Earth Day.
Not your birthday.
No.
Okay, I would never talk about your birthday and embarrass you on the air. But here's the lame thing that's going to happen on Earth Day with some of these fast food restaurants that contribute to all of this insanity by selling poor ground-up cows and things and ground-up baby chickens and stuff. And Carl's Jr. is going meat-free on Earth Day is the headline on one of the news sites, the veg news sites, one of the vegan veg news sites. But then when you read on, it's only going to be at one location in Los Angeles. They're in an arrangement with Beyond Meat, and they're going to be giving away some free Beyond Meat burgers, so it's a big publicity thing. But I guess that's their idea of contributing to Earth Day. They're going to give away some free Beyond Meat burgers.
That's dangerous, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's great, but it's dangerous because are they acknowledging that 364 days of the year they're contributing to
basically,
global warming?
Yeah, basically, that's kind of what they're doing.
And in all their other restaurants?
Like you said, it's a UNESCO play. It really is. It's theater of the absurd out there. When you wake up to it, it really is scary that everyone else is a rhinoceros and you are someone who will not capitulate, as Berenger says in the play.
Well, I kept reading The Vegan Imperative, and I read a lot of other things on being vegan. And meat is murder. Meat is murder, meat is murder,
yeah,
meat is murder.
It
I don't
is.
Want to hold back anymore. It's wrong.
And it is imperative that people go vegan. So that's where this conversation with you and I started, was when one day I just flashed on, has anyone ever used the title Vegan Imperative? And you said, I don't know, let me check it out. And you did, and this is when you found David. And it's a great book, and David's an extraordinary animal rights activist.
What I like about the book... it's just an honest exposé on what's happening. He interviewed a bunch of people on why they eat the way they do. And some people know they should be vegan and just aren't. And some people were and now they're not. And some people want to be and they're trying and it's a journey.
And it's imperative that they try harder.
They need to try harder.
Do or do not. There is no try.
Yes, Yoda. Yoda's not a vegan.
No.
Or at least Baby Yoda isn't a vegan.
No.
Yeah.
But Baby Yoga is a vegan.
Baby Yoga should be a vegan.
Baby Yoga should be a character. I think we should start it. Baby Yoga.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is my birthday coming up in a couple of days.
And it is Earth Day.
I have made no plans. I have no idea what kind of cake I want. Normally, I like to make myself a cake.
Well, this will be exciting then because you'll decide...
In the moment.
In the moment. And it'll be all the more festive.
I did make a big stack of corn tortillas.
You did?
3 dozen of them. And I thought afterwards that I should have put a big candle on top.
If you could do whatever you wanted, what would you do?
That's an interesting question.
Would you go to a fancy schmancy restaurant? If you could?
Yeah, I suppose if I could, I don't know. I'm nervous now about going to restaurants.
Yes, I know.
I keep dreaming about one of my favorite places to go was a vegan Chinese food restaurant.
Right.
And I'm afraid to go to one now. Not just because of COVID, but because...
Of that thing you were talking about earlier, salt, sugar.
Salt, sugar, and fat.
Yeah.
We've eaten so cleanly this year during COVID because we've been eating at home. And I'm afraid of how my body might react if I ate this oily, sugary, salty food. Has anybody experienced that? Going super clean?
I have. I'm raising my hand. I've experienced that with you this last year. Well, this will be your second birthday then from pandemic headquarters at Responsible Eating and Living.
Yes.
So
marches on.
We'll have to come up with a wonderful menu and make something wonderful as a dessert. And do something nice for the environment on Earth Day and every day.
And that doesn't mean... using more energy efficient light bulbs. That always drives me crazy. One of the top Earth Day recommendations. No, the best thing you can do is 1, go vegan. And if you're already vegan, try and pressure some other people to go vegan.
If you're already vegan and you've pressured as many people as you can pressure into going vegan, try to pressure some more. I have some really good news about the fashion industry. I used to wear Stan Smith's, but then I found out they were made of leather, the tennis shoe. But now Adidas is releasing a vegan Stan Smith. Ironically, it's made from mushroom leather.
No.
Yes.
You could eat them too.
Yeah. So Gary's going to be wearing... Gary, the guy that doesn't like mushrooms, is going to be eating mushroom bacon and wearing mushroom shoes.
Yes.
Is
well,
that
mushrooms
not ironic?
Are really amazing. And we heard a lot about them last week.
Right. And there's another nice tidbit of information here. We have an Instagram page. It's Responsible Eating and Living Instagram page. And so check us out. Follow us on Instagram.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on Pinterest. Follow us. Follow
on Twitter.
And that's Responsible Eating and Living. Responsible Eating and Living is the nonprofit organization that produces this podcast. It's all about food.
At the Progressive Radio Network. Yay! Progressive Radio Network.
Well, Gary.
Happy birthday, Karen.
Thank you, Gary.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Karen. Well. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you, Gary, and thank you, everybody.
Have a delicious week.